Good day. Today is Monday, 17th November 2025. And let me remind you again, before I proceed with this video, to tick the like button if once you've watched the video or whichever part of the video you want to watch, you like what you've heard and decide that you want to indicate that fact. Well, with that, let's proceed. And let me first of all begin a few short comments about the latest actions of the President of the United States, President Donald Trump. Now, President Trump has been busy over the last couple of days. He has engaged in a series of extraordinary personal attacks on two of his former supporters, Representative Tom Massie and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. He's spoken about them or written about them on Truth Social in, frankly, most uncomplimentary, I would say even offensively insulting terms. And by the way, along the way, he also spoke in a very unfriendly and uncomplimentary, and I would say also insulting way about Senator Rand Paul. Anyway, he started out all of those attacks, and it was not difficult to work out what was driving a lot of his anger. Clearly, Massie, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Rand Paul have been critical of various things that the president has been doing, and they've been getting increasingly critical of some of his foreign policy positions. But in my opinion, without any real doubt, the thing that really angered President Trump was the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tom Massie, and perhaps especially Tom Massie, who was one of the co-sponsors, were pushing a bill through Congress which would have required disclosure of the unclassified material in the Jeffrey Epstein case. And President Trump has, for the last few months, since May, set his face against disclosing the material in the Jeffrey Epstein case. He's spoken out, in fact, strongly against doing so. He's referred to the entire Jeffrey Epstein affair as a hoax. He has vehemently denied any personal involvement or wrongdoing in Jeffrey Epstein's affairs. And, well, he has gone back massively, or he went back massively against his previous election commitment to disclose all of the Epstein material, inviting huge amount of criticism and causing great distress amongst his formerly extremely loyal electoral base. And last week, we saw some of the effects of that. There were elections, or 2 weeks ago, I should say, there were elections in the United States, interim elections in various states. The Democrats had runaway wins pretty much across the board. We did a detailed discussion of this entire topic with the US Attorney Robert Barnes, who, in my opinion, has an unrivaled granular understanding of the domestic politics of the United States, one which is much deeper and far more accurate than my own. He pointed out that the scale of the defeat for Republican candidates in such a set of elections is all but unprecedented in the last 50 or so years. And, well, obviously, economic factors, the worsening cost of living situation in the United States played a key role, but undoubtedly unhappiness about the president's reversal of his position on the Epstein affair played a role too. Well, today, the president has reversed himself again, having insulted the primary Republican backers of the bill to disclose unclassified information about Jeffrey Epstein and his operations. Today, the president has essentially capitulated and has said that he's going to support the bill after all. Now, coming after the attacks, the public attacks on Tom Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I have to say this straight away, this does not look to me like a graceful acceptance by the president of the inevitable, that he's going to lose badly in Congress in a way that essentially obliges him to support this bill, failing which he would be heavily defeated, putting himself and in an impossible political position. As I said, it was not a graceful retreat from an untenable position, political position. It was a graceless capitulation in the face of an impossible political position. An astute, politically astute, politically confident president would have called in Tom Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene, told them that he'd made a mistake, that he accepted the mistake, that they were right after all, and would have told them that having reconsidered the matter and listened to what people were saying, including people from across the United States and from his own electoral base, that he had decided to change his stance and would support the bill. But of course, after those personal attacks, he's in no position to do this. And in fact, his comments after his statement that he now supported the bill continued to be graceless. He said that there was nothing in this material that would be at all embarrassing to him personally. By the way, about that I agree. I think that given all of the investigations, given all the allegations, given all the claims that have been made about Donald Trump ever since he came down the golden lift in Trump Tower in the summer of 2015 and involved himself again in active politics in the United States, I can't imagine that if there was anything really damaging and really serious about him in the Epstein material, that it would not have been disclosed by now. Bear in mind that all of this material has been for a long time in the possession of the FBI, which, from what I can tell, from what anybody can see, for most of the time since 2015, has been intensely hostile to Donald Trump. So I accept his assurance that we're not going to see anything that is going to be especially damaging about him personally in the material. But then he went on to say that the people who would be damaged by it would be the Democrats, because they were far more heavily implicated in Epstein's affairs than he himself was. Again, I'm perfectly willing to believe that is true. There are all sorts of prominent Democrats one can name who do seem to have been very heavily involved with Epstein and who, for example, were booked on flights on his private jet. However, Trump saying all of that merely begs the question of why, in that case, he opposed disclosure of this information at all. Now, here I'm going to make a number of points of my own. Firstly, one of the most interesting things that's become clear over the last couple of weeks is that right up until the moment of his final arrest, and despite his earlier conviction, Jeffrey Epstein was continuing to play a very major role, not just in American public life, but in the world of global diplomacy. he was having meetings with the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin. He contacted a prominent member of the Norwegian government in order to set up a meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, in advance of the 2018 Helsinki summit meeting between Putin and Trump, telling the Norwegian minister that he had information about Trump, which the Russians might be interested to know of. Suggestive and interesting comment. It seems that the Russians didn't take him up on that offer. There's no record of him having spoken to any Russian officials in response to this outreach, and certainly there's no record of him having actually met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And in addition to all of that, it seems as if Epstein was also trying to arrange a back channel between the Russian government and the Israeli government, from what I can see, acting mostly on behalf of the Israeli government in connection with the Russian intervention in Syria after 2015. And again, it doesn't seem as if those contacts led anywhere very far. But I do remember that in 2015, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Moscow, and an agreement was indeed reached between the Russians and the Israelis at that time to set up a deconfliction line for their air forces operating in Syria. And, well, I can't help but wonder now, in light of what we've just learned, whether Jeffrey Epstein had any role in that. Probably not. I've seen no evidence that he did, but one is left to wonder. And the Jeffrey Epstein did have considerable contacts with, maintained right up until the end, considerable contacts with very prominent members of the American political class. I'm not going to name anybody, but it's there all over the media. Former Treasury Secretary, for example. He also maintained very close contacts with a former Israeli Prime Minister. In this case, I will name him, Ehud Barak, who appears at one point to have been Epstein's partner in some kind of business enterprise involving, so far as I can tell, surveillance technology, though I might be completely wrong about that, the latter, in which case, if I am, I apologise. All I am saying is this is extremely active operations by Jeffrey Epstein involving all sorts of very important people, genuinely important people, using Jeffrey Epstein, using contacts and networks that he seemed to have developed in order to influence and shape international relations. And I would say that based on the information we've seen up to now, which admittedly is probably only a microscopic fraction of the total, Epstein's major interests appear to have been in the world of international diplomacy rather than anything else, perhaps just possibly centering on the Middle East. Anyway, there we are. We have all of this information. And of course, to me, that again begs the underlying unanswered question about Jeffrey Epstein, which is, why was this single individual playing such a huge and active role in international affairs? Why was he maintaining contacts, as we all know, with the brother of the man who is now King of England, King of Great Britain? Why was he so close to prominent British politicians, or at least to one of them, Peter Mandelson, recently, until very recently, Britain's ambassador to Washington, former minister in Tony Blair's governments, formerly a commissioner, a European commissioner at the European Commission in Brussels, and an individual who is always part of British power, the British power system, even when he's never really been in office, at least up to now. Anyway, how is it? Why were all of these people giving so much of their time and energy to conversing and corresponding and arranging meetings and having messages with Jeffrey Epstein? Why did Norwegian ministers want to have interactions with him? Why did Russian ambassadors want to have interaction with him too? Why did former Israeli prime ministers want to have interaction with him also? Now, I am, of course, very well aware of the speculations that Epstein was involved in intelligence and that he was an intelligence agent of one particular country. I've seen so far no proof of that, and I have to say this, though it is a possibility that might explain lots of things. But I have to say, it seems to me that the range of his contacts go beyond that and beg further questions. Bear in mind a point I have made already in many programmes, that Jeffrey Epstein was obviously an immensely rich man by the standards of most of humanity. By comparison with the billionaire class that is such a major player in society and economics and politics in the West today, was not even an especially rich man. And I've already pointed out that the scale of his lifestyle, his apartment on the Avenue Foch in Paris, and in fact he owned the entire apartment building in that incredibly expensive street, which I know very well, by the way, his ranch in the United States, his mansion in New York, the two Caribbean islands he owned, his private jet, the manner and way in which he spent his money, all of that appears to me to have exceeded the potential of his known fortune. And there's never been a real coherent explanation as to how that fortune ever came about in the first place. So, a man of extraordinary mystery in many ways, and the mystery just goes on growing. At least that is what I think. And I'm going to say this, people should not have over high expectations of this bill, because even if it is eventually translated into law, which presumably it will be, the only information that we will be entitled to see is information which is currently unclassified. I'm going to make a guess that that represents only a small fraction of the total, which is spread out over security services, intelligence agencies, various parts of the US government bureaucracy, parts of the bureaucracies of many countries. All of that information will continue to be classified also. And bear in mind, just to repeat again, that these activities that Epstein was involved in continued after his conviction and seemed to have been unaffected in any way by it. All of the people who he was interacting with must have known about this conviction, but it doesn't seem to have concerned them or affected them in the ways that they interacted with Epstein at all. Now, it would in theory be possible to obtain answers to all of these mysteries, all of these questions. But that obviously cannot happen unless the President of the United States himself is fully on board. Given how graceless Donald Trump's response to his forced reversal on the Massey bill has been, given the fact that he opposed the Massey bill in the first place and has spoken about the whole Epstein affair as a hoax, I can't help but think that he has no intention at all of taking this matter any further in any way, and that he will resist all demands which are bound to be made for further declassification of these papers. Anyway, there we go. A very complex, very strange affair. One, as I said, which throws up more and more questions, at least for me, all the time. One which perhaps one day full answers will be provided, though I wonder whether that will happen, being realistic about it, in my lifetime. Anyway, there it is. Now, going on from this, we've also had other steps and statements by the president himself. He has again floated the possibility of an economic blockade on Russia. He's now talking again about Congress passing legislation to sanction countries that continue to have economic dealings with Russia. This looks like an attempt to revive the Lindsey Graham, Richard Blumenthal bill of the summer, the one which threatened countries which buy Russian oil with 500% tariffs. And this might, by the way, be connected with the expected decision from the Supreme Court of the United States, which it seems will say that the president's existing tariffs are unconstitutional. Lindsey Graham has tried to sell his bill to Trump as a way to make tariffs constitutional on the basis that any tariffs imposed by the president on countries which trade with Russia would be constitutional since they have been authorized by Congress. And one can always find some evidence that any particular country is indeed engaging in trading with Russia. So it may be that. But again, it is not going to help the president's overall and underlying position. Because, of course, what Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal and the hardliners in Congress, and by the way, the hardliners in the Treasury Department who want to increase and escalate their sanctions and who now see tariffs as another nice sanctions tool which they can deploy, what they are currently targeting most of all is Russia's energy exports. And, well, a number of things immediately come to mind as a result of all of this. Because the country that is currently buying the largest amount of energy from Russia, and which is entering into co-agreements with Russia on energy matters, is of course China. Now, the Russians have now begun work on Power of Siberia 2. They have started the various studies and preparations for the construction of Power of Siberia 2. As the Financial Times has conceded, that in itself requires a heavy investment in funds, and the Russians would not be doing this if they were not confident that Power of Siberia 2 would indeed be built. And, well, the Financial Times pretends that China has not agreed to Power of Siberia 2, despite a clear agreement between Putin and Xi Jinping over the course of Putin's visit to China in August to move forward with power of Siberia too. Anyway, the Financial Times pretends that this is still unresolved, even though, of course, it is resolved and there is a joint Chinese-Russian commitment to build power of Siberia too. And the Russians, of course, continue to supply oil to China, and oil continues to be pumped to China through Power of Siberia 1, which is already in operation, and by ship, and I have no doubt that continues, despite various claims in some parts of the media that it has stopped. I see no evidence that it has stopped, and I don't believe that it has stopped, not in any way. Anyway, so the United States has already fought a succession of economic skirmishes with China over the course of this year. It launched an economic attack on China in the form of massive tariffs in April. It tried, or it found itself catapulted into doing exactly the same thing after the Treasury Department in September went back on a tariff truce that the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had negotiated with China in September by massively increasing the number of Chinese companies that were subject to US sanctions, did so by orders of magnitude, something like 20-fold. And step the US has been forced to reverse. And of course, all of that failed because China responded. They responded by taking steps relating to rare earths. And the United States, after a recent meeting between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping in Singapore, says that the Chinese have agreed to soften these regulations on rare earths. But a slew of articles which have appeared in the media now says that China has not, in fact, reversed or relaxed or toned down in any significant and effective way its tighter regulations on rare earths, and they remain in place and are capable of being activated at any time. And of course, it's not just rare earths. There continues to be a crisis over the Nexpedia company, which produced middle and low-end chips, many of them used in the auto industries in Europe and the United States. The Dutch government, under pressure from the United States, took control of Nexpedia's Dutch headquarters, ousting the Chinese-appointed CEO of the company, who is a Chinese national, and putting a Dutch national, handpicked by the Dutch government, in his place. That has led to a rupture between Nexpedia Netherlands and Nexpedia China. The Dutch and the Europeans and the Americans have discovered that without the cooperation of the Chinese partner, Nexpedia chips cannot be finished and are therefore unavailable to the car industry. And again, there were reports about a week ago that the Chinese were relaxing their restrictions on these chips, and again, this has proved to be untrue. In fact, chip shortages relating to Nexpedia continue to cause growing pressure on the German and American and other European car industries. So all of this is happening, and here we have the President of the United States and some people in Congress threatening further sanctions against China because it might be continuing to import Russian oil. and in fact might be continuing to trade with Russia altogether. Now, to repeat again, there is absolutely no possibility that China is going to sacrifice its long-term economic relations with Russia, because that is what the United States wants. My very good friend Brian Beletic has recently posted on X a post about certain commentaries in the United States which make it perfectly clear that the US military are still working on their plan, which goes back all the way to the Obama administration, to impose a sea blockade on China to choke off imports, vital imports for China, of food and energy and raw materials. And if only for that reason, given that Russia is in a position to break that kind of blockade, it has a continuous border with China, it is also in a position to supply goods to China by pipeline and ship and by rail and by road. And the seas, China's seas and Russia's seas, are contiguous with each other. And of course, Russia is perhaps the most blessed country in the world in terms of energy and raw materials, and indeed food as well. The Chinese are absolutely not going to jeopardize or sacrifice a long-term relationship with Russia, which is vital for their long-term security. Doing such a thing would increase China's vulnerability and would expose China to precisely this very sea blockade that the Americans have been so busy working on. So, given that that is so, the Chinese will not sacrifice their relationship with Russia. And if this bill that the president is talking about were to come into force, and if the president were indeed to enforce it, he would again find that both he and the United States have been catapulted all the way back into an economic war with China, in which China holds all the high cards. It can stop exports of rare earths. It can stop exports of chips, and by the way, of all kinds of other critical components. And I am not saying that this will bring the entire US economy and industrial system to a stop, but it will cause major and deepening economic difficulties, which would probably over time become more and more intractable. And that is true not just of the economy of the United States, but the European economy also. So, is the president really going to do that? Even his pressure on India, by the way, despite what some people are claiming, looks to me unlikely to work. There continue to be claims that India has stopped buying Russian oil. In fact, to my knowledge, India's national oil company has placed orders for Russian oil to be delivered to India in December. More importantly, the visit by President Putin of Russia to India is still on course, apparently. Apparently, a massive range of agreements, including on military-industrial cooperation, are being prepared. The Russians, for example, have just displayed their newest iteration of the Sukhoi 57 stealth fighter jet with advanced new engines. Apparently, this is an extensive reworking of the Sukhoi 57. This, by the way, is very typical of the Russians. If you go back to the Soviet period, you will find that the Russians would often work on a fighter jet, bring it to production, put it in service. The moment it is in service, they would then begin a massive redesign exercise. By this point, all of the underlying problems in honing the design would have been worked out. And very, very soon after, initial production of the early version of the fighter jet had appeared. The real version of the fighter jet, the one that was intended all along for long-term serial production, would be appearing on the scene and would be brought into mass production. And then the early versions would be available for export to previously the Soviet Union's and today's world, Russia's friends. Anyway, just saying all of this. But the fact that the Russians are now displaying this fighter jet on the eve of Putin's trip to India is a further sign for me that cooperation between India and Russia on military industrial processes is coming. Is Trump really going to go ahead and impose massive sanctions and penalties on India when he cannot do the same against China? Does he understand what the effect on opinion in Delhi of that would be? Just saying. Anyway, there we go. So the president is talking about doing all of this. Again, I get the sense of an aimless but angry man. He's not really thinking things through. He's reacting constantly and impulsively, frustrated by his lack of leverage, and angry with the Russians for not giving him what he wants, and is basically throwing around the furniture like a spoiled child who isn't given the sweet that he is yearning for. That's, I have to say, how it looks like to me. Anyway, that's Russia. Now, what is very interesting about this is that even as the president is threatening more sanctions against Russia and more tariffs and sanctions against Russia's trading partners, we've now had from Bloomberg a whole lot of information about the effect of the existing sanctions and other things. And we've also had reports from the Ukrainian media about Ukraine's own energy war against Russia. Let's start with what the Ukrainian media has been saying. Now, over the last couple of months, in fact, over the last year, Ukraine has been launching escalating drone attacks against Russian oil refineries. And there's been a widespread narrative that these have done massive damage to Russia's refining capacity. I remember reading in the late summer, just a few weeks ago, in fact, that something like a third of Russia's refining capacity had been taken offline. There was a brief period in the late summer when there were queues at gasoline stations in Crimea and other southern resort cities. By the way, Stanislav Krapivnik, who of course is very familiar with these things, tried to point out that the queues in Russian gasoline stations in holiday areas over the course of the holiday season in the summer is absolutely routine. It's what you regularly see. But of course, that found no mention in the media in the West. The president himself, President Trump, bragged about the fact that the Russian people were facing problems with shortages of gasoline. He actually said that, and that there would be queues at gasoline stations, and he bragged about this in a Truth Social post. Anyway, all of that, and well, now the Ukrainian media is telling us finally the truth, that in fact refining capacity in Russia, oil refining capacity, might have been reduced, not by 30%, but perhaps by about 3%, and that given the enormous amount of spare capacity in the Russian oil refining sector, this has made no significant difference to the situation with gasoline supplies in Russia, at least gasoline supplies as supplied by the Russian energy industry. Now, I have been saying this all along. In fact, I've been saying this time and time again. Now, Ukrainian media outlets are admitting this. Vladimir Zelensky's great drone offensive to create havoc in Russia's oil refining sector has been a dismal failure. In terms of its effectiveness, it scratched the paint. I will look forward with interest to seeing admissions, acceptance of this in the various media publications in the West, which ran with this phony story, just to say. Anyway, that now brings me to, again, the question of the energy sanctions, because though Ukraine's drone offensive against the Russian energy complex has made no significant difference, by the way, just to say, Russia's oil exports, as is true, by the way, of US oil exports, are overwhelmingly accounted for by unrefined crude oil, just to say. Anyway, nonetheless, there's been an article in Bloomberg which, whilst it talks about Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil refineries as having affected global supplies of oil, as I said, that is not true, also admits that sanctions, that US sanctions, and not just US sanctions, but European Union sanctions as well, are also disrupting the world oil market. And as for European sanctions, well, the Europeans have just made decisions that the European Union, apart from one or two countries like Hungary and Slovakia, which will still retain carve-outs, the Europeans, are going to stop importing Russian oil and liquefied natural gas after 2027. And they've also imposed sanctions on what they like to choose to call Russia's shadow fleet of oil tankers. Oil tankers, in other words, that carry Russian oil, but which are not sanctioned, but not insured on the London insurance market. Anyway, the European Union, as I said, has imposed sanctions on Russian energy. And of course, the United States has done so. Also, it's recently imposed sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. And presumably, Trump's latest comments represent a threat also to extend and enlarge and widen these sanctions and to convert them into secondary sanctions. Now, countries that import Russian oil that are not part of the global, of the Western energy Western alliance will one way or another continue to import Russian oil. But it is impossible to impose sanctions like this without causing problems in global energy markets. The Russians will have to work out further workarounds. The president of Kazakhstan, Tokayev, was in Moscow. Kazakhstan and Russia have just concluded another major economic partnership agreement. I don't know the details. Maybe oil played no part of it. But personally, I would not be surprised if some oil that trades globally as Kazakh oil actually originates somewhere in Siberia or someplace like that. And I am sure that an awful lot more of that is going on and will go on. But if you have to engage in these kind of workarounds and subterfuges, even if they are workarounds and subterfuges that everybody knows about and everybody tolerates because nobody can afford even more disruption of the global supply chains than we are already seeing. Nonetheless, some level of disruption is bound to take place. And inevitably, unavoidably, this is going to increase energy costs. And that is exactly what Bloomberg says is currently happening. Despite the fact that over the course much of this year, there has been an oil glut and prices have fallen, prices of energy in the United States and in Europe have continued to be higher than they should be if the energy markets were working efficiently. And with OPEC Plus likely to reduce production, I read a fascinating article about a week ago, again in the Financial Times, about the financial pressures on the Saudi government, about how MBS's grandiose Noam City project, which always seemed to me a fantasy in the desert, a mirage in the desert, how that has cost billions and looks unachievable. Anyway, the Saudis are going to want to balance their own budget. In fact, their budget is in heavy deficit at the moment. They're going to want a higher price of oil. So will the other Gulf producers. So will oil producers generally. Already it looks as if OPEC at least, is going to start moving perhaps more aggressively next year towards bringing the oil glut under control, which they can only do by cutting back production. So already we see the drive to intensify sanctions on the Russians causing higher energy costs in Europe and indeed also in the United States. And we saw the electoral results again. When I said a short time ago at the start of this program that the Epstein scandal has undoubtedly lost the Republicans' votes in the recent elections, I believe that an even bigger factor was the general rise in the cost of living in the United States, which, make no mistake, is definitely connected to higher energy prices than would be the case if there were no sanctions and if energy markets were functioning efficiently. And of course, if the United States is going to be hit in that way and living standards in the United States are going to stagnate or even fall, then that inevitably weakens the president's popularity and his political position. I have been reading over the last 24 hours a cluster of articles about this, including one which said that President Trump is repeating all of the same mistakes that his predecessor Joe Biden did, and is allowing higher inflation in the United States, which is undermining his political position. Well, if he repeats President Biden's signature policy, which was economic war against Russia, if he goes even further than Biden did by threatening economic war against the whole world, unless they stop buying Russian oil, which is going to disrupt energy markets even more, then what does he expect? What does the media expect in this situation? It utterly baffles me that the president and his advisors could be getting this so obviously wrong. Anyway, there it is. We are apparently locked into this position. I should say that in Europe, it is even worse. I was reading, I think it was again in the Financial Times, about how Chancellor Merz is now apparently agreeing to provide subsidies to German industry to try to cushion the effect of higher energy prices. Chancellor Merz is pumping out debt on expensive infrastructure and defense programs. He's pumping out debt in order to plug holes in Germany's inflating social security budget. And now he's going to pump out still more debt in order to cushion German industry from the effect of higher energy prices. Again, the obvious absurdity of this is obvious. His latest plan, apparently, which he's also discussed with the European Commission, is to dust off an old proposal from the Juncker era, the Juncker being one of the earlier presidents of the European Commission, a predecessor of Ursula von der Leyen. Anyway, the idea then was to have a unification of capital markets in Europe, in effect to have a European stock market, as opposed presumably to a German or French or Italian or whatever it is stock market, a single centralized stock market that supposedly will solve all of the problems. It will solve the problem of French debt. It will solve the problem of German debt. All it will do in reality is it's going to create more and more debt. And the important thing to understand is that it is German taxpayers, and not just German taxpayers, but European taxpayers, who are going to be burdened with the taxes needed to service and cover this debt. It is a terrible idea. And the German savings banks, once a key pillar of Germany's economy, one that was, by the way, closely interconnected with the CDU, Chancellor Merz's party, they have apparently published a excoriating report, fiercely denouncing this idea, which is exactly what you would expect conservative savings institutions to do. But of course, no one in Berlin, at least no one in the coalition, certainly not Mr. Merz, who, as we know, was formerly connected with BlackRock, and a debt production vehicle, if ever there was one. Anyway, no one in the government in Berlin appears to be listening to the advice of, as I said, the German savings banks, who were critically important institutions in the past in Germany's economic system. And all of this in order to have to pay for higher energy costs, which are themselves the result of the economic war and the sanctions that you not only impose, but which you continue to escalate. Now, over the last 24 hours, the European Commission has also circulated a letter to European governments, a letter signed off by Ursula von der Leyen herself, which continue in defiance of the warnings from Euroclear to push the idea of a loan of 140 billion euros to be provided to Ukraine using the frozen Russian assets as some form of collateral. In this letter, apparently, Ursula admits that there are legal risks to this proposal, which is an extraordinary admission, by the way, when a letter of this kind admits to the existence of legal risks. Then any court that administers this objectively, this issue objectively, would quickly say that that is an admission of illegality. Why otherwise talk about risks? Anyway, this letter says that the European Union should move forward with this plan because the alternatives are either debt mutualization, in other words, euro bonds in order to raise this money, or direct transfers by states, national states, to continue to prop up Ukraine. All three are, of course, disastrous ideas. The proposal for the loan that Ursula von der Leyen proposes using the Russian assets and euro bonds and direct intergovernment transfers. All of them are bad ideas. Of course, the first is by far the worst, as the CEO of Euroclear has now warned. But I found it interesting that every report about this state's statement says, or at least doesn't say exactly, but makes it clear that the actual alternative, the obvious thing to do in this situation, which is to stop transferring money to Ukraine, to accept that this process of sending money to Ukraine has now reached its end point, that is something that Ursula's letter does not suggest, or I suspect even discuss. Nothing perhaps sets out more clearly the nihilism of current Western policy. You are given a choice between three terrible options, and you're not allowed to consider the rational one, the rational one, which is just to stop. Over the course of a programme that Alex Christoforou and I did on this whole topic for the Duran, Alex also mentioned another proposal that's apparently floating around, which is to take 140 billion euros out of Norway's sovereign wealth fund and to transfer all that money to Ukraine by way of a loan. In other words, take the money from the Norwegians. This is the money that the Norwegians have been saving for their future. But give 140 billion euros of that to Zelensky and his people, the people who've now been found with briefcases full of cash and golden toilets and those sort of things. Give it to them. Plunder your sovereign wealth funds. Come up with disastrous options. But never, under no circumstances, slacken off on the economic war. Now, let us turn now to towards the end of this programme, to the fast evolving military situation. Now, there's been more news from the battlefronts of Ukraine over the last 24 hours, and it is more of the same, by which I mean that the situation for Ukraine continues to deteriorate. A German journalist, Julian Röpke, him of Bild Zeitung, whom I mentioned many times, is apparently saying that Russia has enlarged the territory it controls over the course of November by more than it has done at any point in time in a single month since the end of Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive. The Russians have massively, in other words, expanded their, well, not massively, but they have significantly expanded their area of control throughout the year, but especially so in November. Well, I am not somebody who's particularly interested in numbers of square kilometres that the Russians capture in any particular month. But over the last 24 hours, we've had a cascade of news. The Russians have completed the capture of a string of villages around Gulyapolye. I think that it is now only a matter of time before the encirclement of Gulyapolye begins. I discussed yesterday in my programme at some length the significance of the Russian capture of Malaya Tokmachka, the village of Malaya Tokmachka, near to the town, the Zaporozhye town of Orekhov, and how the capture of Malaya Tokmachka has an impact both on Ukraine's ability to hold on to Orekhov itself, but also to the prospects, the abilities of the Russians to complete their encirclement of Gulyapolye. I'm going to express my own view. I think Gulyapolye, within a few weeks, will be encircled and will probably fall under Russian control sometime this winter, perhaps fairly soon. And in the meantime, further north, the Russian advances continue. Every single day, the Russians report the capture of more important villages and settlements in this area. The fighting for the important small town of Veliko Mikhailovka has apparently got underway. Perhaps even more dramatic, Novopavlivka, the strongly fortified town in the north of Dnipropetrovsk region, which was supposed to be the great barrier that the Russians would be stuck at for weeks and months. Anyway, apparently that has collapsed, and the latest report I saw is that the Russians now control around 80% of it. This has been a remarkably fast collapse of what was once an important fortified position. One way or the other, the Russian drive westwards towards the Dnieper is accelerating and looks increasingly unstoppable. And there was a long article in, of all places, the Daily Telegraph, which came close to admitting to this truth, and which said that the reason the Russians are able to advance westwards as fast as they are in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions is because all available Ukrainian troops have been diverted to try to hold back the Russians in the Pokrovsk area, leaving the Ukrainians in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions critically short of men and supplies and equipment. Now, in Pokrovsk itself, there's been more footage which appears to confirm Russian control of at least of all of the northern territory of Pokrovsk. I saw one claim that said that the Russians control around 98% of Pokrovsk, which, by the way, I think is probably about right. And I should say that over the last few minutes, the Russian Defense Ministry has spoken about a Rubicon FPV drone operator tracking movements of civilians in the village of Grishino, just to the west of Pokrovsk, which gives a sense of how close the Russians are to that village as well. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry has provided some information about the situation in Pokrovsk, but it's not particularly insightful. They say that assault groups of the Second Army continue to neutralize surrounded Ukrainian troops in the Tsentralny district and in western parts of Gorniak district, as well as in the western industrial area. And Russian troops continue mopping up Ukrainian militants, as they call them, Ukrainian troops, in Rivne. So, to me, that really does sound like clearing operations. There's obviously lots of holdouts scattered across Pokrovsk, but the Russians seem to be going through them systematically. I don't think anybody any longer who retains any degree of realism about the state of this battle now disputes that the Russians do indeed essentially control Pokrovsk. Ukrainian mapping projects, as I discussed yesterday, have now reduced the size of the Pokrovsk cauldron by around 40%. So that would suggest that such Ukrainian forces as there still are inside the cauldron are indeed limited to a territory in northwest Mirnograd. In relation to that, the Russian Defense Ministry says that in Mirnograd, units of the 51st Army continue offensive operations in Vostochny district and the southern part of the city. Over the past 24 hours, up to 290 troops, 3 armoured vehicles, 4 pickup trucks and field artillery guns have been neutralised in the Pokrovsk area. And in Mirnograd, assault groups of the 5th Motorised Rifle Brigade conduct successful combat operations near the Zapadny district. More than 30 buildings have been liberated. So the Russians in Mirnograd are again on the move, and they're gradually reducing the size of the cauldron, and they're putting more and more pressure on the Ukrainian troops who are trapped there. And in Kupiansk, the Russian Defense Ministry has given, actually, in some ways, even more dramatic information. They say that assault detachments of the 6th Army continue to destroy encircled Ukrainian troops close to Kupiansk. Over the past 24 hours, 2 attempts to conduct counterattacks and unblock the encircled enemy units have been thwarted. And then they give details of the numbers of Ukrainian troops who have been killed or wounded or taken prisoner, and of the extensive amounts of equipment that the Russians continue to capture. It looks to me as if most of the fighting is now taking place in Kupiansk, actually outside the town to the south, and that Kupiansk itself is also now basically entirely under Russian control. What's left are the Ukrainian forces located to the east of Kupiansk, in the open fields, and Ukrainian troops who are also located in some of the outlying suburbs to the south. So anyway, that is what the Russians have been saying about the situation in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. And as I said already, there is a deepening crisis for the Ukrainians in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions, and one which is now starting to create more and more alarm. There's also information about what is starting to look like a new crisis for the Ukrainians in the north, in Kharkiv region. The Russians are apparently now essentially in control of Volchansk, but perhaps more importantly, the Russians appear to have captured a large belt of Ukrainian territory in Kharkiv region, east of Volchansk, along the border. And I say along the border, but it's clear that the Russians have pushed significantly to the west of the border. And this morning, apparently, group of forces north announced the capture of a village, which I believe is called Dobyshevka, which is located well inside Ukrainian territory, quite a significant distance from the border. And there are speculations, which I suspect are true, that the Russians are going to create a new group of forces in this area. In other words, the group of forces north is going to be reinforced and then divided into two separate group of forces, one focused on Kharkiv region, the other perhaps focused on Sumy region. Who knows? I'm guessing now. And that at some point over the next few weeks, the Ukrainians will be facing a major crisis in Kharkiv region as well, comparable to the one that they're facing in the south in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions. Well, as to all of that, we will have to wait and see. But that the situation for Ukraine gets worse every single day, it's impossible any longer to deny. You can go to all kinds of Ukrainian Telegram channels. You can read what people like Bezugliya and Berlinskaya and others on the Ukrainian side are saying. You can read an agonized tweet, post on message on X, published by the German correspondent of Bild Zeitung, Julian Röpke, about the catastrophically worsening situation. You don't have to go to the Russian side of the internet to see how bad the situation is. You can find abundant information about it on the Ukrainian side as well. Meanwhile, President Zelensky of Ukraine does what he always does when he's under pressure. He goes on a tour of European capitals. He's been to Greece, where he's concluded an entirely fictitious agreement about importing LNG, American LNG, through Greek ports. No doubt this will happen, but he didn't need to go to Greece to agree to it. And besides, LNG supplied to Ukraine from Greece is hardly a solution to Ukraine's current energy problems. He's also gone on to France, where he signed another mostly fictitious agreement with his dear friend Emmanuel Macron. He will no doubt visit Brussels very soon, where he will be meeting with his other dear friends, Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas. Then I'm guessing he will cross the channel and come and meet his dearest friend of all, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who is, of course, rapidly on his way down and out, but who will no doubt nonetheless take time to greet his dear friend Vladimir Zelensky and to hug him once more outside Downing Street. And of course, President Zelensky will be on his way to Berlin, probably on his way back, to meet his new dear friend, Chancellor Merz of Germany. So Zelensky is on his tour, and of course it also gets him out of Kiev, whilst the corruption crisis there continues to fester. Events in Ukraine, by the way, has a very interesting discussion of this corruption crisis in Ukraine. Like me, the writer of that very interesting blog does not believe that this crisis has indeed been initiated by the United States. And like me, this person who knows the situation, the political situation in Ukraine very well, he too doesn't believe that there is any serious attempt to oust Zelensky from the presidency. All of the parties understand that doing such a thing at this time would simply accelerate what is probably now an inevitable collapse. He suggests that this particular corruption scandal has been instigated by European governments and their supporters in Kiev as part of an exercise in putting pressure on Zelensky to purge some of his closest supporters, including his very powerful chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, which is possible, and also to force Zelensky to do the thing that European governments have convinced themselves will somehow save the situation, which is to announce mobilization of young Ukrainian men from the age of 18. Now, I don't know whether this is correct. I have to say it wouldn't surprise me if it was. It is the case that far too many Western politicians and officials seem to be obsessed with the idea of getting Ukraine to lower its conscription age. I have to say that I find doing this one of the most inhuman and callous things that I can think of, forcing young men of another country to go and die in their tens of thousands in the most horrible way on Ukrainian battlefields in order to buy European politicians, presumably just a few more weeks and months of time. Once upon a time, I would not have imagined European leaders capable of acting like this, but of course we see that they do without so much as turning a hair. So quite possibly events in Ukraine is right about this. I don't know. I hardly think it matters. I don't propose myself to get into the business of trying to analyse and understand these Ukrainian palace intrigues, which is what I consider this corruption scandal to be, or the motivations of the parties behind them. In my opinion, for what it's worth, it's more likely a scramble between power brokers in Kiev to get their hands on the money flow before it finally stops when it becomes clear that the war is lost. Anyway, that's what I think about this. I have an even more cynical take, perhaps, than events in Ukraine does. But anyway, that's that scandal, of course, goes on. But if put by the way, events in Ukraine does make one interesting point, which is that whenever there have been scandals of this kind in the past, whenever Nabu and Sapo have appeared to expose baroque levels of corruption within the Ukrainian political system, the end result invariably has been no prosecutions of anyone at all, and there is no reason to think that this time it's going to be any different. But what is perhaps interesting, the one interesting twist of this story, is the movements of Ukraine's former defense minister, Rustem Umerov. And he was forced some months ago to quit as defense minister of Ukraine and became secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council. And for a time, he headed Ukraine's negotiating team that was meeting with the Russians in Istanbul. And he crossed swords with Russia's chief negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky. And then, as I discussed in my program yesterday, we heard that rather conveniently, in order to get him out of Kiev, before the investigators caught up with him, he'd gone to Istanbul, supposedly to restart negotiations with the Russians, the very negotiations which the Ukrainian foreign ministry had been suspended for the remainder of the year. But anyway, he'd supposedly going back to Istanbul to get those negotiations restarted to negotiate another prisoner exchange. And I discussed this all yesterday, but now I learn that he has left Istanbul, he's left Turkey, and he's now in the Gulf. He's now visited Qatar, and he's also gone to the UAE. And there's no clear explanation of why exactly he is there. Well, let me provide an explanation, my own explanation. I don't know that this is a true one. This is all guesses now. But could it be that the reason that Mr. Umerov is in the UAE is because the UAE, and to some extent Qatar, are also major financial and banking centres. As everybody knows, Dubai, for example, is today a major banking centre. Could it be that with worries about continued funding from the West, worries about Ukraine's long-term viability, worries about the corruption investigations in Kiev, somebody, Umerov, Zelensky, Yermak, someone else, wants to make sure that any money in these accounts, in accounts in the UAE, in Dubai, and in other places, is properly looked after. Just saying. Now, to repeat again, I don't know that is necessarily so. You could come up with other reasons why Umerov might be in the UAE. The UAE is a place where Russians also go, and it might be that he's gone there because he's hoping to meet someone important from Russia. Maybe some kind of contact of that kind is taking place. But I retain my cynical view, and, well, I've just stated what it is. My own sense is that the real purpose of Zelensky's travels around Europe is to make sure that if and when the moment comes when people in Kiev, key people in Kiev, need to make a quick dash, the reception in Europe will be friendly. I think that this is what this is mostly about. And who knows, Umerov's trip might have some connection to that too. Well, there we go. In the meantime, as I said, the Europeans at least seem determined to go on sending shiploads of money, literally shiploads of money. At least if you had them all in banknotes, it probably would be shiploads. Shiploads of money to Ukraine. By the way, on that front, there's been reports that there's been damage to the railway tracks between Poland and Ukraine. Somebody has caused some damage. I wonder who. I don't think it's difficult to guess. Already the fingers are pointing to the Russians, and for once that might be right. Anyway, all of that is going on. Tomorrow I'm going to discuss Sergei Lavrov's extremely interesting interview with the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera, which provides even more information about the interactions between the Americans and the Russians in Alaska and thereafter, information which is damaging, in my opinion, to President Trump. And I will discuss what I see as Russia's existing diplomatic strategy, to the extent that such a thing is even needed anymore. But anyway, that will be for my programme tomorrow. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, X, Rockfin, wherever. You can also, by the way, find all our programmes and articles that I and others are also writing on our new Substack site, the Duran Substack site. Remember also that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember, as I said at the outset of this program, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.